Mr. Lanzo's, that he has suffered past persecution. As a result, he is a refugee under the Act. The only way to find that he is not a refugee is if there's a finding that there has been a fundamental change such that he no longer has a well-founded fear of future persecution. The BIA is tasked with making two determinations. First, whether there's a fundamental change in conditions, and second, whether that fundamental change is such that Mr. Lanzo would no longer have a well-founded fear. The BIA made two errors in this case, or potentially three errors in this case. First, they did conduct an individualized analysis, perhaps you could argue. However, they made two errors in that analysis. They made two errors in their analysis. I would say they made three, but I'll start with two. First, the two errors I would say that they made is that they shifted the burden to Mr. Alonso to show that he would suffer well-founded fear of future persecution, and they relied on impermissible factors, again, shifting the burden to Mr. Alonso. And third, in their analysis, they are not allowed to pick and choose what they're going to rely on. So going to what the fundamental changes in this case that they've known, I would say that the BIA found the fundamental change was the 1996 peace accords. And so what is the analysis they did? They said they reviewed the entire record and they looked at the experts.
Are you getting something? Didn't Mr. Gayax go to Guatemala several times in the 1980s and 90s? And did not suffer persecution on these occasions, correct?
Well, I would say that that's a mischaracterization of the record, and I would also say that those factors occurred before the fundamental change. So I would argue that those factors that the judge, that the BIA...
But even before the peace accords, he was not persecuted.
Well, he was persecuted.
Now, the peace accords somehow made it worse.
Well, no, I think if you look at the full record and you look at the country conditions until the peace accords, Dr. Grandin, the expert, is clear that he was continuing his opposition work in a clandestine manner. He was in hiding. If he had tried to do his work not in hiding, he would have been killed. All activists at that time were murdered. They were executed. And so I don't think anybody, reasonable fact finder, could find that an opposition leader like Mr. Alonso, who had already been arrested, tortured, and labeled a subversive, could live in Guatemala safely. He was living there in hiding. He was being
surveilled. He also enrolled in law school for a year. That's not what I would call hiding. He's not hiding.
Well, I think, I mean, there was a lot going on in Guatemala, and that's how the movement was being put forward, was through the universities. And so in order to be part of the university student movement, he needs to enroll in the university.
I think the question that Judge Reyes is pursuing, and frankly I have the same concern, based on the numerosity of visits, and the only incident that I think he testified to was the sighting of the suspicious Jeep and the radio traffic that he heard. But the fact remains that he did not suffer any further harm on all of these visits. And the question is whether or not the board or the IJ look at that fact coupled with the signing of the peace accords in 1996 and conclude that there was no objective fear of future persecution. Isn't that what they were focusing on?
Well, sorry. He is a presumption of well-founded fear stemming from the past persecution, and I would argue that those events were all part of the same past persecution determination, and all of those factors...
I think you're quarreling. I thought they concluded that those subsequent events were not evidence of persecution because he wasn't hurt.
What I'm saying is once past persecution was found, I am saying they were within the ambit of the past persecution because he's entitled to the presumption of well-founded fear. And so in order to overcome the presumption, there has to be a fundamental change. And so there's
why isn't the fundamental change from the signing of the peace accord in the reforms that have occurred, which was the subject of the State Department report.
Right, so I agree that that's what the BIA said was a fundamental change, and I don't know how you can take that fundamental change and apply it backwards to events that occurred prior to the fundamental change. That's how I interpret this fundamental change.
I'm sure I understand what you said.
His return trips to Guatemala occurred before the fundamental change. So the fundamental change...
But I guess my question was, the board court's characterization of essentially what I'll call safe return trips that occurred after the acts of persecution. And then on top of that, we have the 1996 peace accords. And after that, we have the State Department country condition reports, which say what they say. And why isn't that substantial evidence to support the board's claim that there had been a change in country condition?
Because I would argue that, the board is not tasked with determining whether there's been a change in country condition. The board is tasked with determining whether there's been a fundamental change such that Mr. Alonso would no longer experience, would no longer have a well-founded fear of
future. And is the CBS saying, does that evidence rebut the presumption that he is otherwise entitled to?
Right, but if the change in country conditions was in 1996, how could a 1996 change in country conditions affect his presumption of well-founded fear? You would have to look forward to determine whether it affects his presumption of well-founded fear. You can't look backwards and apply a change in circumstance that occurred after his return trips backwards, because then you're putting the burden on him, really, to show that he had a well-founded fear.
Maybe I misunderstood the timeline. I thought that the actual physical abuse occurred prior to his returns to Guatemala. Isn't that true?
Yes.
And somewhere in there we have the 1996 peace accords. So why isn't that all evidence that the board can consider in determining whether or not he has an objectively reasonable fear of future persecution?
I'm going to make sure you have that.
Sure, I'll have to save your time.
Because, again, the incident occurred in 1978 where he was arrested, imprisoned, and labeled as subversive and tortured. That's past persecution. And so he's entitled to a presumption of well-founded fear of future persecution. There has to be a fundamental change in circumstances.
After 1978, correct?
Yes, after 1978. And so, I guess the question is the fundamental change in circumstance that he returned to Guatemala? I mean, if the board is saying that the fundamental change of circumstances is not really the peace accords, but that he returned to Guatemala in 1990 through 1993, without suffering arrest and detection. To determine, I think it's putting the burden on him to show that he has a well-founded fear, but even if you feel that it's not, that that's changed circumstance, I don't think that the record bears out that he did go back to Guatemala safely. He was hiding in his brother-in-law's tailor shop. He was still in opposition of the government. He said himself that he had a 99% chance of being killed. And then we have the expert opinion by a well-renowned expert on country conditions in Guatemala that said this is exactly how the government operated at this time. They would surveil opposition leaders and eventually execute them, and that Mr. Alonso was lucky to escape Guatemala before the peace accords in 1993 when he last escaped it. Right, and this court, a couple things about that. This court has held that a change in government alone is not sufficient to find a fundamental change in circumstance. It needs to be shown that that the applicant would no longer have a fear of persecution under this change in government. And so I would say Dr. Grandin's report found in his expert opinion that there's a high probability that Mr. Alonso would be harmed if he returned to Guatemala, that the death warrants were still operating clandestinely, which is how they operated in the 1980s and 90s. And so, yes.
Okay. You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, Dan Holman, on behalf of the Attorney General, the government asks this court to uphold the agency decision and deny the petition for review. This case presents some interesting questions, and I think I'd like to start by urging this court to note that there were really two separate claims here. There's a claim based on the petitioner's past political activism, student activism in Guatemala. He's found to have faced past persecution that creates the presumption of future persecution or support. But then there's a separate claim, and it's an independent basis for relief. That's not my words, that's petitioner's words in his brief. He describes it as an independent basis for relief that's based on his union activity after he comes.
that the board didn't properly analyze all this, and the petitioner is really trying to blend both of those claims together and to urge this court to consider his union activity here in California as a continuation of his political and student activism in Guatemala.
As far as I read the record, the activity that he had on behalf of the Communist Trade Union, the other authorities, had ended because the Partido itself had been dissolved. So he wasn't working in any Guatemalan union activity. He was only in the U.S. union activity. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of the record, Your Honor. I'm raising this point, though. I think the petitioner is urging this court to look at his union work here in California as a continuation of his commitment to political social activism. My point is simply this. When those two claims are submitted, they're different, and they are necessarily subject to different analysis because the union work in California has never been found to qualify as past persecution. It couldn't be because it occurred here in the United States. So there's two separate analyses there. And I think there is perhaps some confusion even in the record as to what work he is going to do if he goes back. Particularly on page 254 in the record, he's asked though about his union work first.
He's asked, and it must be for my colleagues here, but I'm far more concerned about the first thing than I am with the second. I don't think it's hard to sell to convince me that there is no nexus between the union activism in California, but I am concerned that the BIA seems to have made a pretty highly generalized analysis with regard to the evidence of changed country conditions, and I'm wondering whether the board met a tough standard establishing individualized risk of persecution as to Mr.
Ramirez. I think the short
answer is the right question.
I hope I do, Your Honor. I think the short answer is yes, the board properly applied enough of a sufficiently individualized analysis. Certainly, the board starts with there has been a fundamental change in Guatemala. The Peace Accords were signed. That's in the mid 1990s. But then the board goes on to note several additional factors, and they're not. Then the factors that the board notes are specific to the petitioner's individual claim. They note, for example, as was discussed earlier, that he went back to Guatemala several times.
But that was before the Accords, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But my point there is simply that the question that I'm trying to answer is, was the analysis sufficiently individualized? What the board did not do is say simply, Peace Accords, 1996, case closed. The board started with that, understandably, and that would make the point that this was not simply a change in government, a change from one party to the other. This was a sea change from decades of a dictatorship to a democratically elected government with the Peace Accords. The State Department reports there is a record. Certainly reflect that there are still some difficulties there, but we start with, and the board started with, that fundamental change. If the board had said that and that alone, I would not be making this argument. But the board then goes on to page 4 of the record to note he doesn't know that he and the petitioner could not even testify whether the party that he had been part of was even still in existence, so that even his individual claim. They note that he remained in Guatemala after he was arrested. They note that he returned multiple times, and then at the bottom of page 4 of the record, going over page 5, the board notes that there is no evidence or assertion that the clandestine groups, which is one of the groups that he fears, are targeting individuals such as the petitioner solely on the basis of their past student activism from decades ago.
What about the testimony from the renowned expert?
The expert submitted a declaration, Your Honor, the parties were interested in without testimony, but his declaration, I point out a couple of things. Number one, he's certainly helping the petitioner's case, but one of the things that he says is that this is in paragraph 11 of his declaration, the bottom page, 157 of the record, the clandestine groups continue to target those who work to end impunity or fight for political reform. Just looking at a plain reading of that, he's talking about activists who are currently active in Guatemala. The State Department reports are not inconsistent with that, but he's not talking about the individualized analysis that Your Honor asked about earlier, past student activists, past or former student activists. It's not the question there. Their ongoing commitment to the cause.
You're saying his statement is to be present activists, not past activists.
Your Honor, I'm just reading the statement. That's
the point you're making.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would urge the court to consider as well, this is a statement, a declaration from an expert, but it's prepared for litigation. It certainly is somewhat tailored to the petitioner's case. If there were evidence to offer as to potential harm for former student activists, it could have been in there. And I think the fact that that is not in the expert's declaration is also a fair factor for this court to consider. I'd also like briefly, Your Honor, to address one of the, perhaps the elephant in the room here is the delay. This case started back when the petitioner applied for asylum in 1994. We're here in 2017. I am not going to stand here on behalf of the government and say that type of delay is a good thing or is acceptable, but I would urge the court to consider that this was not a 23-year delay. This was several individual delays. Originally, the first delay, as the petitioner notes in his brief and reply brief, he applied for asylum, and there was an 8-year delay in getting an interview with the asylum office.
But that's not his fault, right? That's the agency being heard in Oklahoma, the Central American.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And our brief at page 24.5 recognizes that, unfortunately, that type of delay in that time period was not out of the form.
But then that stand coupled with the fact that the DHS that they were assigned to the case got transferred or sent overseas or something, and then there was about another 5-year delay.
There was another 5-year delay. There's not a lot of information in the record about it.
Thank you very much. Well, so what's your point? I mean, it sounds like the government's responsible more than Mr. Alonzo for the delay.
And certainly the government bears some responsibility for that delay, Your Honor. I would point out, though, that you know, particularly, though, with regard to that first delay, the second delay starting in 2004, they're in immigration court. He's questioned on direct examination. The government says, wait a minute, we might have a bar to asylum that applies. They want to check it out at this time. And then the record reflects this. Everyone in the courtroom thought they were going to take a continuance, be back in a month or two. There's actually a witness who was in from Guatemala. They wanted to make sure they weren't going to lose their testimony. Everyone thought they were coming back soon. But
is this the issue in this case? I mean, it's benefited the petitioner, right?
I think it did, Your Honor, that he was allowed to stay in the United States. I raised it simply because there's certainly insinuations or implications in the record that in the briefs rather than the petitioner, that the petitioner did everything he could to move this case forward, and the government somehow blocked things. However, in 2004, when the government asked for a continuance, the petitioner didn't object. Now, everyone, as I said, everyone thought they were coming back in a month or two, but when that month or two became, as Your Honor noted, 5 years, there were still no objections from petitioner. In fact, one of the continuances in that time period came from a request for continuance, came from petitioner. So, my point is not that the delays are okay, but that all of those delays, the petitioner was rejected, but when a request for continuance is made and it's not objected to, it's likely to be granted.
But other than the fact that we're now looking at this through the lens of 2017, aren't we stuck with the record that was compiled in 2004? I mean, that's the basis on which we have to make the determination, is it not?
I see what Tom's target
is.
Thank you. Yes, is the short answer. And this court is working on record review. Subject to anyone's questions, thank you.
Thank you. So just to start off with really quickly, denied Mr. Alonzo applied for asylum 3 months after he arrived in the United States, after he fled Guatemala in fear for his life, and he did not cause a delay, but I don't think passage of time is relevant to this decision.
I'm sincerely concerned about the time, because it certainly inured to your client's benefit, at least in allowing him to stay longer.
Well, no, he wouldn't. I don't think any of this would come up if asylum was, you know, adjudicated in 94. But in any case, Your Honor, I want to just address a couple of things. The BIA shifted the burden to Mr. Alonzo. In fact, they created such a high burden for him when the BIA said that he has not shown that he would be persecuted solely on the basis of his past membership in Guatemala in opposition groups. That is putting a burden that is not even put on applicants who have to show well-founded fear of persecution. Rebutting the presumption should not be putting Mr. Alonzo in a worse position than if he were applying for just applying for asylum and showing well-founded fear of future persecution. Dr. Brandon's report, he is an expert, which was not challenged in the lower court. It can't be challenged now. He was accepted as an expert, and an offer of proof was made for his testimony in lieu of his testimony. Dr. Brandon, the expert, opined that there was a high probability that Mr. Alonzo would be harmed if he returned to Guatemala. Mr. Brandon didn't know anything about his union activities. It had nothing to do about with his union activities in the U.S. It had to do with his opposition leadership in the 90s in Guatemala. And the BIA cannot pick and choose, and that's what they did in this case. They shifted the burden to Mr. Alonzo, and they chose not to even address the expert opinion. And there is an individualized expert opinion in this record that says there's a high probability that he will be harmed, and there's nothing to contradict that expert opinion.
So is your argument, using my characterization of the broad generalities that the board relied upon, is your argument that that's simply not sufficient to rebut the expert testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's required even the government to go forward with its own expert or some better evidence than what they had.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
So should we remand this to the board to reopen or what?
I would argue that no reasonable fact finder, based on this record with Dr. Grandin's report, saying that there's a high probability that he'll be harmed, that there, no reasonable fact finder could look at the evidence and the record as a whole and find that that a well-founded fear has been rebutted. But alternatively, yes, a remand so that the BIA could apply the proper analysis and not shift the burden would also be sufficient.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.